Final talk of the afternoon here, and my name is Paul Arbison. I'm going to just install this here real quickly. Somebody removed my files, so I'm going to put it back here for you. This will do. All right. This will work. This talk is called 0123. And it's about the dimensions of religious thought. Let me change the lighting here a little bit. All right, this will be a little better. Don't have a lot of time to pursue all of this. What?
Do we have a light back so we can take some notes?
I'm going to turn on the lights in a few moments.
Oh, okay.
Wanted to just give you an opportunity to explore the range of religious views that, by religion, I mean not just Christianity, but world religions. And I'm just going to look at one aspect of this, the sense of dimensions, the dimensions of logic in different religious streams of thought. So I'm oversimplifying and abstracting religion down to only one kind of framework, and that is in terms of its dimensionality, the logic of its dimensions. So this is a very big oversimplification of a very big subject. So I'm thinking of it in terms of Picasso's abstraction of a bull here. You might, before I begin to frame this, though, I have to go into some background information. The Tao is this idea that C.S. Lewis present in his book, The Abolition of Man. He's suggesting there's a kind of background framework of morality and judgment that we see around the world in ancient history, and we also can see it in our own childhood. The background beliefs and sense of fairness, sense of justice that we have as a general, what I would call a non-philosophical moral framework. He quotes the Chinese here. They speak of this great thing called the Tao, the reality behind all predicates, the abyss that was before the creator himself, nature, the way, the road. You might just think of it as the way. He analyzed it down into several categories. General beneficence, duties to parents, elders, ancestors, children, posterity, justice, good faith, mercy, basic sense of morality that Christianity quite often you hear the term common grace. Romans chapter 2 talks about the Gentiles that don't have the law. They have this background knowledge that is kind of our preliminary background. So C.S. Lewis just calls it the Tao. There is a right way and a wrong way. There's a right and a wrong. There's fairness. There are distinctions between things in reality. We must make a choice between them. All natural languages include negation. That's implicit here. The idea of yes and no, true and false, good and bad, is implicit in the background of the world belief. Now, around 2,500 years ago, Buddha, Gautama Buddha, took a different direction. And this is very ancient tradition, but Buddha, about 500 B.C.? This is circa 2,500 B.C. Now, that's too far. It's 2,500 years ago, it should say here. He recognized, like we all do, that life is tragic. We see pain, suffering, illness, old age, death. In this situation, there is no escape. We all know that we will encounter suffering. We'll encounter illness. Our loved ones will die around us. Our friends will depart, and then we will depart in death. What is the root cause of this, and what is the solution to this human condition, this existence in samsara? The solution that Buddha came up with was to eliminate the distinction between true and false, yes and no, right and wrong. In other words, to eliminate all distinctions. So his astonishing philosophical move was to reduce the dimension of logic from this antinomy, this antithesis of yes and no, to zero, no distinctions. Once we have no distinctions, there's no distinction between suffering and non-suffering, between the life and death. How do we achieve a mental state where we can detach ourselves because we have these desires for being free from pain, free from death? How do we solve this? Through detachment, through enlightenment, by breaking through it, this natural logic that we were born with. So in Buddhist meditation, and of course I can't reproduce this in 10 seconds, but typically the Buddhist monks will meditate, and they can work on this discipline for perhaps 10 years and achieve some level of awareness of this zero-dimensional logic. And so it would come through meditation on nothingness. How do we achieve this distinction, this loss of distinction? Well, I've tried to illustrate it visually because I can't describe it propositionally. Just take a look at Buddha here, all right? And let's just see what happens as we go through. I don't have time to go through the readings. I would recommend that if you want to pursue this, take a look at a book like Zen Flesh, Zen Bones. It's a classic. It's been around for 30 years. To see how using stories, koans, and various parables, Buddhism attempts to achieve a mental state of that's not describable. If I could describe it, I'd be using propositional logic. I can't do that. I have to do it with non-propositional words, or not even words. We try to say, teach without using words. Now, there some scholars, this is an Indian Buddhist, Nagarjuna. Here's a quote. "If nirvana is neither being nor non-being, no one can really understand this doctrine which proclaims at once negation of them both together. What is the Buddha after his nirvana? Does he exist or does he not exist? Or both? Or neither?" See, those are the four possible logical options, right? We will never conceive it. So here Nagarjuna is using propositional words to lift up the ladder and remove it and get up into the clouds and leave you in a non-propositional thought. So American writers have adopted Buddhist thought in many ways, but the main concept is that it has no. We are saying no here. I'm playing games. I know, but the point of it is that we have no antitheses, no distinctions, no parts, no definitions, no beliefs, no arguments, no God, no atheism, no theism. Okay? It's not about that. It's about reducing logic to the idea of a mathematical point. A point has no direction, no properties, no attributes. It's just a zero-dimensional space. And so this is a journal called Zero, Modern American Buddhist Journal. Some religious authors have picked up on some aspects of Buddhism. Particularly, they're fascinated with Buddhist meditation and its power. And of course, the neuroscientists are picking up on Buddhism and fascinated with it now and tapping the brains of Buddhist monks, trying to figure out what it's about. I'm just suggesting that it has to do with... there's many schools of Buddhism. Of course, if it's been around for 2,500 years, more than Christianity, it's developed a lot of denominations and schools. And so you have Theravada Buddhism and Mahayana Buddhism and Hinayana Buddhism and Zen Buddhism and all kinds of schools of thought. But they all have this same fundamental underlying dimensionality of zero. Now, let's move. We're in philosophical thought now, not in the pre-philosophical era. In modern philosophical thought, that is modern, I mean something like going back to the time of Moses. The philosophers, the Greek philosophers of Socrates, Plato, Aristotle, systematizing one-dimensional logic, propositional logic, and making a general abstract rule about what is this logic. Laws of thought, identity, antithesis, and the excluded middle. Right? If something is a chicken, it's a chicken. Right? If something is a chicken, it is not a non-chicken. Right? If everything in the universe is either a chicken or not a chicken. Those are the three rules of logic. Okay? And so all propositional assertions presuppose the laws of thought, including that statement. If you're making a statement, you're affirming that this is what I believe and I don't believe the opposite. Right? So, in religion, what do we have? One-dimensional logic in religion. And, of course, this is where the law is very prominent. The law says, do this, don't do that. This is right, that is wrong. So, if you read, for example, in the Proverbs, very strong, clear, well-defined antithesis. Lots of proverbs about the righteous and the wicked. Very clear. The wise and the fool, the rich and the poor, us and them. I don't know about you, but when I read about the proverbs and the righteous and the wicked, I often try to think, now let's see, which category do I fit in? Am I the righteous or am I the wicked? I have evidence for either one of those. I'm not sure which category I fit in. But because this is the thinking pattern, it's a one-dimensional logic. I could take time to read some samples of these, but I think you get the general idea. The Mishnah is an extrapolation of the law into the very microscopic details of daily life, trying to define precisely how much water we can carry on the Sabbath before it breaks the law, things like that. Also in... And so here's a sample from the Mishnah, the commentary on the scriptures. From Islam, same story. A lot of legal language. As for those that strictly observe the scriptures and are steadfast in prayer, their reward shall not be lost. There's certain laws, certain rules. It's simplified. It's much more simple than the Mishnah. But after Muhammad came a continuing series of records in the Hadith that carries on this concept of a one-dimensional thought pattern. So now I want to move to the next dimension. Now, when we change dimensions, lots of big changes happen in the thinking pattern. There are some hints of this in the Old Testament, particularly gets clear as we go into the New Testament, particularly in the writings of Paul, where we're seeing the limitations of the law and seeing the need for us to move beyond just saying, even in Proverbs, Solomon sometimes realized this. I have kept my heart pure. I have clean without sin. Who can say that, right? So you see in the New Testament a transition from one-dimensional thought to two-dimensional thought. Same in Greek philosophy, particularly in Aristotle, the development of a two-dimensional logic called the Synelon. And I'm going to share a little bit about that. The Greek philosophers were pondering fundamental questions of physics. And so Aristotle's physics dealt with questions like the one and the many problem. Is the world one thing or many things? You know, these are debated in great detail. I have laid out a picture of a two-dimensional logic, and I've illustrated it with one example that's a familiar example to us as Christians. We are called to be in the world, but not of the world. Right? We are called to be in the world. We're not called to be out of the world. Right? That's an antithesis. A, not A. We are called to be not of the world, not worldly. We're called to be... that's another antithesis. So there's two dimensions here. We are called to be these two upper ones, but not the two lower ones, right? We're not to be worldly, of the world. We're not to be separated out of the world, right? So here's the way that pattern would look. I just separated it into four boxes. These two diagonals are antitheses. In the world, most Christians are called to live in and engage the world. That's what we're doing here in ASA. On the other hand, we are not of the world. We are to avoid and oppose the evil in the fallen world, right? If we say, well, we want to be in the world, well, on the other hand, that does not mean the exaggeration that we are to be worldly, because then we'll be distracted by the cares and pleasures of this world. On the other hand, if we are not of the world, that doesn't necessarily mean that we should become monks and hermits and get out of the world and be separate. It's affirming these two upper parts and not the two lower parts. So the structure is like this. We have these two parts as we're affirming. They complement one another. These two are exaggerations. All right? And you can see the way the pattern is developed. These two exaggerations you get by negating one of the things we're affirming. So it's locked together. It's a two-dimensional logic. And I found that a lot of the Christian doctrines fall into this pattern. For example, transcendence and immanence. We say God is transcendent. We say God is immanent. God is transcendent. The creator is distinct from the creature. Right? On the other hand, that doesn't mean that that God is wholly other and the universe is autonomous. That would be a dualism. We do not mean that God is separate and outside and unreachable. On the contrary, we believe that God is immanent and present and active in all space and time, right? But that does not mean that the universe is merely an extension or an emanation of God, like Plotinus might teach, pantheism or panenthism. So there's a balance here in these doctrines. Here's another one. The two revelations of God, the two books of God. Nature is the general revelation that declares the glory of God. We do not take the exaggeration of naturalism. Scripture is the special revelation, which shows the way of salvation. We do not say that all knowledge must be derived from Scripture alone. Okay? So these are two interlocking doctrines. The justice and the mercy of God. Another example, God is just, God is love. They complement one another. We do not say that God's mercy is universal because that would compromise God's justice. We do not say that God's justice leads to condemnation of all without hope. There is hope, right? So we have these balances in the logic of these different doctrines. There's a third dimension, if we could... see if I can show you that here. And this stuff is all, by the way, on my website. If you want to pursue it further, I can give you some examples. But I'll show you the end of this slide here. There's some cases where I've found three-dimensional logic. And 3D logic occurs in the case of a doctrine of the unity, diversity, and equality. For example, in the church, the doctrine of the church in 1 Corinthians 12, it's talking about the spiritual gifts that are diverse among different people in the church, right? But we are all one body in Christ, right? And the different parts are treated equally among each other. And that's all taught in 1 Corinthians 12. Christology, the two natures of Christ, very carefully worked out doctrine. This was, of course, worked out, you know, Augustine in the Middle Ages, where all the different combinations and permutations were debated. And after a long time of centuries of debate, finally, the church settled on a formalized creedal statement of the doctrine of the two natures of Christ. And that falls into this pattern. The same thing occurs with the Trinity, the doctrine of the Trinity. And you can apply it to marriage and the relationships in marriage. So these all basically come down into a framework based on these three dimensions: unity, diversity, and equality. There's other doctrines that fall into these three dimensions: sovereignty, creation, and providence. So most of the talks that I've been hearing the last couple of days here fall into these three dimensions of sovereignty, creation, and providence. That's mostly the kind of issues that we ponder in ASA. Those three doctrines apply to questions around what is the nature of nature, what's the nature of human nature, even the question around evil has some, you can see some structure in that. So I'm suggesting that the way that we can organize the religions of the world into these different dimensions. There's a pre-philosophical background, which C.S. Lewis calls the Tao, the way, which comes from our childhood or comes from ancient history. There is a zero-dimensional culture in Eastern religions, primarily flowing out of Buddhism. There's a one-dimensional legalistic framework of religion that comes primarily through Judaism and Islam. There's a two-dimensional structure that emerges from in the New Testament and from some of the Greek philosophers. And then there's a three-dimensional structure that we see emerging from the period from the medievals to Reformed Christianity, and it's reflected in some things like the Westminster Confession of Faith and places like that. So that's the framework that I see, and I'm just suggesting that we could put this together. But there are radical distinctions from one dimension to the next between these different ways of thinking. Quite often, some of the popular authors and the American Buddhists, they gloss over some of the radical differences in thinking and logic between these different categories. So I'm suggesting that this is a framework that we can use to help sort these out. So with that, I'll take your questions. Thank you. I'm sorry about the lights. Let me turn the lights on. Back in the back.
So go back to your last slide.
Okay.
The question would be, don't Judaism and Islam also have the notion of doctrines based on sovereignty, creation, providence, such as nature, human nature, or evil, are also...
Yes, now dimensions refers to the space that does not refer to entities or substances or essences or things. So I'm not talking about monism and dualism and things like that here. I'm talking about the space, the logical space within which we describe those doctrines. Okay.
So don't those faiths have the logical space and interpret nature, human nature, origin, evil in terms of sovereignty of Allah, creation of Allah, and providence of Allah?
I do not see the subtle relationships that I see in Christian doctrine. I don't see them.
Not in that. Even in Averroes or Avicenna?
I can't hear you.
Not even in Averroes or Avicenna, the medieval Muslim scholars?
In Avicenna and the Moors, they certainly course, copied a lot of the Aristotelians, and they were probably Aristotelians themselves. So to some extent, yes, they probably brought in some of that thought. But that, you know, so there could be some overlap in the thinking there. I'm not trying to be pejorative or judgmental about any of these different groups. I'm just trying to show a way of distinguishing them, a framework for sorting them out.
That's a great response to the claim that all religions are the same.
Yeah, that I would say, yes. Thank you. Uh-huh. Yes.
Thank you. With sovereignty, creation, and providence, would that be a cross-textual information database that would inform those, or would it have to come from a coordinate set of texts?
Somebody took away all my files off the computer. But if you go to that website, it describes what we mean by, for example, what I mean by creation is the things that have been created, right? The idea there is this is a real world that exists outside our minds. We're not subjective idealists. It's a realism. And sovereignty means the sovereignty of God, the rule of God over his creation. And then providence refers to the ongoing, sustaining actions that God does in the world. Right? So those are the basic three themes, and I see those three concepts in some combination or other in all of these discussions. You know, and basically, as I see it, they boil down to those three fundamental principles in some combination. It's difficult to illustrate that in PowerPoint. It lends itself to hypertext because you have to click around a lot of things to see the connections. So it's called hypertheology. So if you just do a Google search on hypertheology, you'll get to this material. Uh-huh. So we are out of time. So please go to the business meeting if you have a chance. And thank you for.